I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Violent crime, including homicide, rape, assault, and robbery, is down in Philadelphia compared to last year. Police-involved shootings for 2016 and 2015 stayed the same, a drop from 2014. The Philadelphia Police Department got high marks for its work during the Democratic National Convention this summer, a very different approach compared to 2000, when there were multiple arrests and lawsuits involving protests of the Republican National Convention, which was also here in Philadelphia. But that doesn't mean there weren't challenges and controversies. Our guest, Richard Ross, has been Philadelphia Police Commissioner for a year. He's a 27-plus-year veteran of the force and was former Commissioner Charles Ramsey's first deputy for 8 years. And Richard Ross, it's been about a year. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. How would you assess crime and policing in Philadelphia for 2016?
Well, I mean, it's a challenge. It continues to be a challenge. But one of the things that we are happy about is that violent crime and overall Part 1 crime is actually some of the lowest numbers we've seen since the early 70s. And we did that evaluation the other day. So couldn't be more proud of the men and women in this department, both sworn and civilian, as well as the many partners we work with, federal, state, and local. But we've got a number of community-based organizations and individuals that work behind the scenes to help us stave off a lot of this criminality out here.
I'm interested in, I guess, the challenge of policing, I guess, post-Ferguson. And also, there were 67 law enforcement officers shot last year, three that were killed in Baton Rouge. And I'm seeing, according to WFTV, a female Orlando police officer was shot multiple times this morning outside a Walmart. A massive manhunt is underway for the suspect. So you've got these two poles of policing, as we saw in Ferguson, and the fact that the police officers can be at risk.
Right. So you got this dichotomy going on right now where you got to be very mindful of the state of police community relations across this nation and all the things inherent in dealing with that. You have to balance your messaging and what you do both internally and externally. Clearly, you recognize that people have the right to protest, and we recognize and acknowledge that. But at the same token, we are very concerned about violence committed towards police officers, and our hearts and prayers go out to Orlando Department. I know that chief down there.
Do you?
Yes, I do. And so you also factor in the fact that we had two officers ambushed, both in the same police district, the 18th District, last year.
Shortly after you became commissioner.
Two days in, Jesse Hartnett was violently attacked by an individual claiming his allegiance to the Islamic State. And later on, we had Sergeant Sylvia Young, who I don't really know how either one of them survived. Obviously, their training, but in my beliefs, the grace of God, you know, was there for both of them. So it's a lot going on.
Do you also think in 2016/2017 that overall people, I mean, we all want less crime, of course, but also there's a call for less policing or a different kind of policing?
I think that's the messaging you get. Now, I don't know if it's as widespread as we all believe. And a lot of instances, and obviously you're more pro at this than I am, you hear some of the folks who are more vocal, maybe a little more so than you hear those that moderate group. And sometimes in more private meetings, you hear a different message about not only policing, but the support of. One of the challenges that I think we all share in policing is this notion of the movement, whether it be Black Lives Matter and or other social movements, as well as support of police, the notion that they're mutually exclusive, and they're not, in my estimation. I mean, you can clearly acknowledge that there are issues that we have to work on relative to police reform. But at the same token, that does not mean that you cannot acknowledge that police officers have a difficult job, and you can still support them and still believe that there are things that need to be worked on.
What are the reforms from Black Lives Matter that you think need to be instituted here in Philadelphia?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, from an overarching standpoint, we just got to work on police community relations. I mean, there are plenty of neighborhoods that support us, and they're very outward about that in terms of their support. But there are those that are challenged, and there are some people, quite candidly, I tell police officers, who may even have reason to feel the way they do. And
because
so,
of something police have done?
Maybe something that has happened to them or something that's happened to their families. And sometimes it's just mere perception, which is powerful. And so it's not an indictment of the entire profession. And I think that's what we have to guard against and not fall victim to that. But at the same token, realizing that working on these things will only make us better. It'll make our jobs easier. It'll make people trust us. You hear this thing called legitimacy.
Right.
And these are things that we have to contend with, and we are not going to shy away from it in this department.
Well, let me ask you about Philippe Holland. This was a man who was doing a delivery in West Philadelphia. This was about 2 years ago in 2014. There were two undercover plainclothes, I guess, police officers who were there. They thought he was up to something no good. He thought he was being robbed because they obviously weren't wearing the police uniform. They shot at him. He received $4.4 million, the largest payout that Philadelphia has ever given to,
right,
to the victim of this obviously serious police mistake. What is the message from that?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, they're probably were some policy violations involved in that. One, just, you know, we have a pretty strict adherence about shooting at vehicles because not a lot positive will come from that. The other piece is being mindful when you're in plain clothes. You really got to be aware, maybe even more so than a uniformed police officer, that the individuals you encounter may not know who you are, and what their perception is of you might be far different than what you think it would be. And I think from the beginning, I know I was the first one to talk about this in the press because Commissioner Ramsey was out of town at that mm-hmm. time and pretty much said that I believed that it was probably a tragic mistake. And he subsequently supported that premise, and I think you read that in the paper. And sometimes they happen. But in this case, we're very fortunate that this individual survived.
Yes.
Because it is just a tragic mistake is what it was.
According to the paper, I'm looking at the Inquirer, a police spokesman said that the two men have been on administrative duty since the shooting and that discipline is still pending. Is there some kind of discipline that's going to be administered?
So, I mean, we have a pretty lengthy process, that much of which is what we're dealing with police reform relative to police-involved shootings, a rather, in my estimation, archaic process. And we are, effective the beginning of this year, instituting all these new reforms in conjunction with the federal government, who incidentally will be here this week for a press conference to announce what they feel we've done with collaborative reform in general, the progress we've made. And so the discipline part will be something that I'll look at this week because it is such a long and intensive process. It's mm-hmm. not just a matter of deciding what's going to be meted out. It's all the steps that go before that, some of which just quite frankly need to be modified, and that's what we've done.
The Justice Department, in fact, it was Commissioner Ramsey who asked the Justice Department to look at the Philadelphia Police Department to see if there were things that could be done better. This is what's going to – this is part of that whole process this
week?
This
is part of the process. So there's multiple layers. There were 91 recommendations that they came in and made, and it's always better when there's a collaboration as opposed to a consent decree. Because that's even more daunting to deal with. And when the commissioner left, Commissioner Ramsey, we were probably 30% done, give or take. And now, so we've moved the ball significantly mm-hmm. in the last year. It's important to note that of those 91 recommendations, there's several components involved in each one. So it's not just that simple. But I'm very proud of the men and women who have worked on this and all the efforts that have gone into it. And so you'll see some significant changes in how we do things.
I was looking at some crime reports, and it looks like the highest crime neighborhoods in Philadelphia, the largely North Philadelphia, West Philadelphia, Fairhill, Parkside, Hunting Park, Tioga, Nicetown, Cobbs Creek, and Mantua. Does that sound about right, based
right.
On what you know about this city? Why is that? What is the connection here?
Well, there are certain areas that you mentioned that are plagued with some very significant poverty levels, and it is a major challenge for us, and I have to be careful because in some of those sections, you know, people may hear them and they may like, well, wait a minute, but I'm talking about certain areas within police districts that there are certain areas in North Philadelphia, for example, that have some of the highest poverty rates in the nation. And so within those pockets, unfortunately, much like you'll see in cities like Chicago and many other places, Baltimore, for example, the combination of deep-seated poverty and illegal handguns is a dangerous, dangerous combination to deal with. And, you know, the gun laws in the Commonwealth leave a lot to be desired. And I'm neither pro or anti-gun, but I am for sensible gun laws. Mm-hmm. And but we have to do a lot in this nation to deal with this gun issue, and much of which we must deal with doesn't start with us. I mean, we've got a lot of work to do, and we do it strategically and get smarter about it every year, we hope. But at the same token, we're coming into the game in like the eighth or ninth inning relative to where we stand. And so a lot of other things need to change before it gets to us.
Well, you're talking about poverty. Police departments can't fix poverty. And
no,
this is
can't.
Something the country's been trying to do, I guess, since our conception, and also gun laws.
Absolutely. And so when you look at a lot of these cities, and we're no different, we got a great mayor in my estimation. And we've had some other good mayors, but it is a long, painstaking process to deal with poverty. I believe that poverty needle for us at 26% hasn't really budged very much in the last several years. There's a few cities like New York that have had the positive movement. When I hear about New York comparisons, I mean, I think they're, first of all, a fantastic police department in great cities, but New York is a world-class city, and so it's probably not a comparison that should be made relative to some of the issues that we deal with.
About a minute or so before our first break here, there were two weekends in 2016. One was in September. I think 5 people were killed, 14 were wounded. One in August, 3 people killed, 10 wounded. What was it about those weekends? Was there something unique that was happening those weekends?
Sadly, there's not. And I would love to sit here and tell you.
There was a reason for all of this?
There was a reason. It's clearly what we can see in Philadelphia anyway. It's not just about weather. We had some shootings this weekend, and we had like Arctic weather blowing through. It's no rhyme or reason in terms of the when. Now, in terms of the why, in many instances, it's about people who resort to gun violence because of disrespect, just like it is across the rest of the nation. And some of them are rooted in drug activity or the drug trade. But the notion of disrespect and just people with no ability to reason through situations is something that's so pervasive throughout this nation, and this city's no different.
That is Richard Ross, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been Philadelphia Police Commissioner for a year. In just a couple of months, he will celebrate his 28th year with the force. And we asked him to join us on Radio Times to talk about the last year of policing and crime here in the city, if I can put it that way. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. We've got comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, talking with Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross. He was sworn in about a year ago as commissioner, and he's talking with us about his first year on the job, although he has been with the department almost 30 years, some of the problems facing the department, and his plans to improve the quality of life in the city. Let me a comment from Laurie. Please ask Commissioner Ross to comment on the pockets of heroin overdoses in Philadelphia neighborhoods. And this is a national problem. This is not just an urban problem. How serious do you see this?
Oh, it's very significant. We dealing with it all over the city, but primarily in the eastern part of the city in North Philadelphia. And we've had multiple overdoses. We are working in collaboration with our partners in the city as well as the federal government in an effort to improve upon this situation. As you know, heroin addiction in particular is a very, very significant issue. The ability to help folks dealing with that is something that we struggle with, not to mention the illicit part of it, those who are selling it. I mean, it's a multifaceted issue, but we try to do as much as we can in terms of interrupting some of these drug trades that are lending themselves or leading to some of these overdoses in the form of the drug packaging that's causing these issues, particularly the fatal overdoses. So we have over 1,000 police officers that are trained in the use of Narcan or Naloxone, and they've had some successful saves, both individually and alongside of fire paramedics. And I can't even begin to tell you how many saves the fire department has had, a great organization, right?
Really?
And so it's one of the things that we're just trying to do to play our part, but it is a significant problem throughout the city and the nation. And in many cases, what a lot of people are seeing is the heroin addicted individual doesn't look like the stereotypical person that people thought of years past. And so people who are addicted to opioids are turning to this drug because it's cheaper. But then it gets a hold of you and you can't get away from it. It is probably one of the most difficult drugs to be cured of.
A New Jersey listener says, great topic. People need to follow police instructions when asked. It's that simple. You can complain later. No police equals anarchy. I don't think anyone is calling for no police, but he's
actually there are some. There are. I've been in meetings where people
ourselves.
did say that, but
nonetheless, I mean, how much do you think problems are that people don't do what police ask them to do?
I think it certainly makes it a lot better. I even tell some young guys that I know, even one of whom that I mentor, you know, let the situation play itself out before you try to resolve it real time. Now, let me just be clear. None of that justifies or warrants us mistreating people. I mean, so you have to also guard against that as well. But I think there are certain circumstances, particularly ones that have been described to me, where if you just let it play itself out and let the system, and I know it's difficult for people to have trust and legitimacy in the system, but you got to try to do that because if nothing else, just for self-preservation, let it play itself out and go from there.
I was looking at a video of a brawl, I guess no other word to describe it, in West Philadelphia, and a police officer did tackle, it looks like she was punching a young woman as well. That went viral, as things do on the internet. What did you see in that?
Well, I mean, I saw a disturbing situation from start to finish. And I'll be honest with you, when I first was notified of it, I was at home, and I only saw initially the first video of her striking the young lady, and I was upset, to be perfectly honest with you. Then I saw some context about how chaotic that situation was. If you saw people leaping off cars, they had bats, they had sticks. Very, very chaotic situation. Clearly, there were about, I believe my investigators said they counted upwards of 50 people involved in that melee. And you better believe there were not 50 police officers there. So I'm speaking to the manner in which they were clearly outnumbered in trying to resolve that situation. However, the actions depicted in the video clearly suggest that there's some issues that we need to contend with, and there's no denying that. But I think what is something that we deal with, and it leads to another topic of body-worn cameras, I think if the individual had those, and this that's no fault of her own, we haven't gone to that district, it will help us in a lot of ways to show what we see. Mm-hmm. And we don't deal with edited videos, which oftentimes is what you contend with because, you know, if you show it a scenario in its entirety, it doesn't capture what people want, which is this notion of hysteria and all these other things.
You want everyone to have a camera, every police officer in Philadelphia to have a camera?
The ones who work the street. I think it benefits everybody involved. I think it benefits the public from their vantage point. I think it benefits the police officer. He or she gets to tell their side of the story, unedited. But what's important to underscore with these body-worn cameras is nobody really has the absolute formula across the nation. Most of us are literally building the plane while we're flying it. And so because there are a bunch of different policies out there, I don't think there's one that is right or wrong. And there are a lot of situations behind the scene that people don't realize that go into even trying to build a body-worn camera project, how much it costs for storage, a whole host of things that are policy-related. So it's a very significant undertaking, but I think it's one worth moving forward on.
I mean, do you think it's been oversold, the idea if police officers have cameras, then we can deal with all the problems that we've seen in the last couple of years?
Possibly. Even though I'm a proponent, it's not a panacea. I mean, you still got to deal with people. And when you deal with people, you'll deal with situations where maybe not everything gets captured in a way that you think, and then that leads to people believing that you're doing something untoward because you didn't turn the camera on or the camera didn't capture it. And did your policy capture all the nuances of what you want going on? So there are a lot of things inherent in building these projects. And I say project because that's what it is. But we're still committed to going forward.
That is Richard Ross, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's Philadelphia Police Commissioner, talking about his first year on the job as commissioner. And as I said earlier, he's almost 28 years on the Philadelphia Police Department and was a deputy commissioner before becoming commissioner. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Chris from, looks like Chester Springs, to join us. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I just want to let the commissioner know that I am a big supporter, and when I'm in trouble, I want to call someone who's going to help me out, and the police do that, and so I appreciate all of them all across the country and what they do every single day. But I think that our police are also at war. They might not be in Iraq or Afghanistan, but they're still at war with people who would harm them. And I wanted to ask him, I think there was a program in the late 80s or early 90s, there were two of them that were instituted when we had big crime waves across the country, occurring mostly probably in large cities, in significant populations of blacks, where the police were charged with bringing the crime rate down. And two of the tactics that I've read about in a book called The War on Cops, the two tactics that I read about were called stop and frisk and broken windows.
Right.
And these tactics were used in high crime areas where people were stopped. And it is kind of a humiliating and intrusive policy, but in a neighborhood where residents are being picked off by guns like tin cans on a stone wall, it's supposed to let criminals know that they're being watched carefully and that that can deter some criminal activity. And that now I wonder if in Chicago those policies have been diminished because police are under such scrutiny and they're being criticized for the very work that helps to deter crime.
Well, Chris, let me take your question and we'll focus on Philadelphia because I think Chicago is in a league all of its own. But to you, Commissioner Ross, what do you say back to Chris?
So, first of all, dealing with the stop and frisk issue, obviously very, very controversial. We've never employed it in the sense that other cities have described it. It's we call it a pedestrian investigation. Arguably, it's done the same way. It's supposed to be done with reasonable suspicion where you believe criminal activity is likely to have committed or will be committed. But you still have to do it within the confines of the Constitution. And so you're right. It is very intrusive. And even if and hopefully all the time when the police officer stops an individual with the constitutional guidelines in place that they do so professionally and treat people with respect and dignity. But again, when you're one of the people being stopped, if for whatever reason you just happen to fit the description but you didn't do it, it is a very intrusive action and you hope that people do it the right way. I don't know that there is a absolute silver bullet, for lack of a better word, in terms of dealing with particularly gun violence and criminality. But it's something that the Constitution does afford us the ability to do. With respect to broken windows, it's something heavily deployed in New York City. Again, the belief that if you take care of the little things, it will ensnare even some of the criminals doing the bigger things, as well as to stave off other things that lend themselves to criminality. However, you got to be careful about that, too, because in every neighborhood, people have certain cultures and they do things differently. And maybe you can find yourself falling victim to mistreating people unintentionally, where, for example, someone drinking a open container of alcohol in North Philadelphia may be arrested for it, and someone in the far northeast may not be. And so you got to be careful. Some of it has to do with the tolerance of the neighborhood and the culture of the neighborhood. Just got to be guarded about doing wholesale things, to entire communities because it will get you in trouble.
And is there a danger of overcharging? As you say, these are not major crimes. I mean, there are, I guess, more nuisance crimes, but you end up sort of pulling people into the criminal justice system. They right. really are not a danger to other people.
Right. And I think one of the things that's helping us is when then Councilman Kenney and now Mayor Kenney gave us the ability to more or less decriminalize a lot of things and or write summary citations on the street. In many instances, we are not now compelled to push people into the system, which is, you know, you want the most serious violators in there. I mean, look, let me be honest with you. There are some people who absolutely categorically belong in prison. Other former inmates will tell you that. But I think there are a lot of people who make mistakes, and to just put cases, particularly on young kids in schools, and this is why we are very happy with our programs that we have in terms of decriminalizing small offenses inside schools, because we don't just want to put a criminal record on a kid unnecessarily. It doesn't do anything but create chaos and backlog the system.
That's the zero tolerance policy that...
Right. So and so we've gone a long way and arrest a lot fewer kids for small offenses in schools.
We've done whole shows about stop and frisk, and I know the ACLU came out with a report last year essentially wanting Philadelphia to either stop the stop and frisk or reform it.
Right. And so we've done that, you know, with plaintiff's counsel and the Bailey Agreement. We work very closely with the ACLU, and I think, for as much as they can tell you, we've done some significant work, made some serious inroads with regard to complying with that agreement. Believe it or not, and this is good or bad, depending on your perspective, despite crime being down pretty much across the board last year, we made significantly fewer stops last year, somewhere in the neighborhood of 80,000 fewer.
80,000 fewer?
Fewer.
Interesting.
That's significant. And being more strategic and targeted, the men, mostly young men out there who are wreaking havoc in many of our neighborhoods and knowing who they are without victimizing people who are just going to work and going to school and going about their business.
I was reading about a town hall meeting last year on stop and frisk. It got kind of loud.
Ugly?
Well, you said it. I'll say loud. Do you like town hall meetings? Do you think they're productive?
I think there are things that sometimes you have to do for people to understand on a macro level how people are feeling. But in terms of actually rolling up your sleeves and getting work done, I don't think you get that much done in town halls. That's just my opinion.
Right.
Not opposed to doing them. That one that you just alluded to was downright ugly, got contentious, and though I knew it was going to be that way. There are people who are angry, but there are people who also express themselves in a way that I just thought was downright unprofessional, and this was unnecessary. And I've had some activists who were present who said that some of those people missed an opportunity. And by that, their words, not mine, that you had the mayor, the police commissioner, city solicitor in one place, and instead of having a productive and meaningful dialogue, it was a screaming match where myself and the mayor were called pretty much every name you can imagine, none of which can I say on this radio show. Right. And so I don't know that where that gets you.
But what's a better way than for you to deal with the public?
Well, you have those meetings. First of all, it goes without saying that our captains have meetings all the time. I mean, for them and even myself, it's kind of having a part-time job on top of what you do during the day. But you have to do this to build those relationships to understand what the temperature is out there, what people are worried about and concerned about. But also people need to put their hands on you and be able to touch you and know who you are and what you feel. For me, if I have my druthers, and sometimes I do, smaller meetings, 20 people or so, where you get people who want to get in there, I'd personally rather do 20, 25 smaller meetings than four gigantic town halls. Sometimes, not all the times, town halls lend themselves to speeches and not really what people are concerned about and what they're willing to do, what part they're willing to play. And so I do a number of smaller meetings to include even young people in school. I had a very productive one with some 11th graders who were very candid about what they thought about the police, very articulate about it. And those things are meaningful because you get a feel for what everybody's feeling and not having one small group speak for the masses.
We were talking before going on the air about the fact that from your perspective, there's a police shortage in Philadelphia, and there are a number of potential officers in school ready to graduate and join the force. I also know that you have gotten rid of the requirement that someone have a
60 credits.
60 credits worth, right, towards a bachelor's degree. Why?
Well, for a number of reasons. One, the biggest one was the shortage. Contending with a ongoing shortage for the better part of a couple years now. I'm not going to be fair. I'm not going to say that it's all about 60 credits. It could be about a myriad of reasons. But right. I do believe that was some of it based on a lot of conversations that I had. But I think some people, it came under some severe criticism when I did it. There are some people who thought that it was only about diversity. It's not just about diversity, even though, you know, in a perfect world, particularly in the climate we're in now, you would like a police department that reflects the demographics of the city. But it's also about inclusion. And obviously, we know there's a slight nuance between inclusion and diversity. And for the most part, you know, Philly's a great town, but it's still a working class town, you know, for most folks. And there are people who do a lot of very difficult jobs who want to be police officers who may not have the opportunity because of family or any number of reasons. But why deny people in a city that's a working class city where that ranks so low among the top, I don't know how many cities with college degrees. We're near the bottom.
We are.
And so the pool isn't as filled as it would be in some other cities. And not only that, though, you give people an opportunity. For many people, police, fire, prisons, and University of Penn, and a lot of others, they're the gateway to the middle class. And so why would you deny that in a city with a 26% poverty rate?
Well, we could go on. Commissioner Ross, we have to end our conversation. My thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. That's Richard Ross, the Philadelphia Police Commissioner. We'll be talking more about the dropping crime rate after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, and we just said goodbye to Richard Ross, Philadelphia Police Commissioner, telling us about his first year or last year here in Philadelphia related to policing and to crime. And you might not know it from the news headlines and from last year's presidential campaign. There's been a decline in the country's crime rate in recent years. There are also fewer people in prison, declining every year since 2008. Adam Gelb is director of the Public Safety Performance Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Adam Gelb, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. So what's behind the declining crime rate?
A lot of things. You know, Mari, there's an assumption that a lot of people have made over the past quarter century that the reason that that crime was coming down, and it did peak in the early 1990s, and actually 1991, and the reason that it's been falling is that prisons have been increasing mostly over that time. And in fact, the increase in imprisonment did contribute some to the drop in crime that we've seen since the early 90s, and violent and property crime have come down by half their early 90s levels. But it's only one of the reasons, and it's a minority reason. There are lots of other things that have been going on with government policy, but also things going on in society that have reduced the crime rate. And prisons are really a small part of that. Those things include better policing. There is no doubt a lot of strain in many communities across the country between police and their communities. But as a general matter, police have gotten better about using more data-driven tactics and targeting hotspots and being more effective about fighting crime. There are changes in demographics, and there are lots of other things that have been happening, such as improvements in anti-theft technologies, whether that's home burglar alarms or car theft prevention technology. Car thefts, Marty, have dropped by some 90%.
Wow.
Over that period of time, because cars are a lot harder to steal and because of laws that get at chop shops and things like this. And that's a high volume crime. So there are all these other things that are happening that are responsible for the long-term crime trend. Nobody has some, you know, precise mathematical equation that can tell you exactly how much is responsible for what. But best we can tell, prisons account for at most 25%, probably less than that, but at most 25% of the crime drop. And the really interesting thing that we found in the report that we put out just last week was that for the eighth straight year now, crime and prisons have been dropping at the same time. And what that's doing is really helping after all this time break this myth, this notion people have that crime and prisons have this sort of mechanical inverse relationship, right? That if crime, you want crime to go down, then prisons have to go up. And if prisons, the prison population were to drop, well, then that would mean the crime would go up by some mechanically proportionate amount. And so now for 8 years, we've had falling crime and falling prisons, and I think it's helping reinforce for a lot of people, including folks like the commissioner there in Philadelphia and other police and law enforcement leaders across the country, that we are at a point now of what we call diminishing returns, where more prisons actually don't help you reduce crime and in some ways actually might be feeding on the crime problem.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things that you said. One was changing demographics. And I guess as the population gets older, that reduces the crime rate, just demographically speaking?
That's right. Crime is a young man's game. The peak years for involvement in criminal and delinquent activity are from 16 to 24, roughly. And that demographic bubble in the U.S. has moved through in some ways. And that's why we've seen the juvenile incarceration rate go down substantially as well. We've had drops of more than 50% in juvenile violent crime arrests in this country over the past 15, 16, 17 years since around the turn of the century. And the number of kids who are being held in juvenile facilities is also down by about 50%. So on that front, we're also seeing this scientific evidence that shows that you can have at this point less crime and less incarceration at the same time.
I'm thinking also about the economy, and even going back to 1991, we've had good times, we've had bad times. We had a near depression, of course, with the Wall Street implosion in 2007, 2008, 2009. What's the connection between the health of the economy and the crime rate, or is there one?
It's a great question and something that has been the subject of a lot of study. I wish I or anyone could say more definitively what that connection is. And it's hard to believe that there's no connection. At the same time, I think you and a lot of other observers would have said when we had the economic collapse that you referred to in 2008 and into 2009, that, my goodness, this must be going to spark some type of crime wave, that people don't have enough money, they will get desperate, and they will start to steal. And we just have not seen that at all. In fact, Mari, the property crime rate continues to drop, and it continues to drop, and has over that period at about the same rate beforehand. And it's kind of hard to explain exactly why, and I gave some reasons earlier, there is just not anywhere near as close a connection between these big, broad economic, social forces and crime rates.
Well, and picking up on this technology thing or phenomenon, I should say, is there less purse snatching because people don't necessarily carry cash on their person?
You're exactly right, and there actually has been some scientific evidence generated on this, and people carrying less cash in circulation makes theft less likely target, that you're going to get something that you can easily use. And there's little question at this point that that also has something to do with the macro trend that we're seeing.
That's Adam Gelb. He's director of the Public Safety Performance Project, and that's at the Pew Charitable Trust, talking about their new report that came out last week, the fact that the crime rate and the incarceration rate have been dropping in recent years. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you think. Another contributing factor to the decline in the crime rate has to do with lead exposure. And there's been a lot of discussion of that in the news, certainly here in Philadelphia. There's been a lot of talk about paint and pipes and things like that. That has had an effect on the crime rate, though?
There is some evidence of that. I'm not an expert on that particular aspect of this, but at this point, there do seem to be enough connections between exposure to lead and particularly aggressive behavior to warrant serious looks and remediation.
Why do you think, and this is in part why you're on the show, but mm-hmm. but why do you think the public perception is that we are in a crime-ridden time?
I think it's very simple and straightforward. And I say this, Marty, is a former police reporter, and that is it. If it bleeds, it leads. When you turn on your local news at night, if you still do that, like many people do, the first 5 minutes, often 7 minutes of a local TV newscast is going to be a rundown of all of the crime that has happened in a community. And often, if there's not a serious crime that's occurred in the immediate community, they will go to a surrounding community and even further out to fill that top of that newscast with things that are sensational and are believed to be of interest mm-hmm. to the viewership. And so, you know, on the one hand, you have to say that these kinds of things are news, and even if the rate over time is coming down, there's still terrible things that happen, and people in the community need to be aware that they're happening. At the same time, without the context of the long-term drop in crime being part of these stories and helping explain to people that, in fact, as terrible as this is, we're seeing some progress made on this front, you do create with people a sense that crime is increasing. In fact, public opinion surveys show that almost half of people think that crime is still on the rise, and this goes back several years now, even though it's been, as we said earlier, dropping since 1991. Almost 50% of people think crime is on the rise, and then another significant chunk think it's about the same, when in fact it has been dropping significantly. Mm.
Have you looked at Chicago specifically? Obviously, there's a serious crime, especially violent crime, problem in Chicago. Is Chicago an outlier, or does it represent something unique as we talk about the decline in the crime rate?
It does seem to be an outlier with respect to the size of the spike in shootings that that are happening there. But unfortunately, there are a number of other cities around the country that are seeing similar increases in shootings. What's interesting about this is that there are a couple things that seem to be common threads across these cities, including rise of opiate use and heroin markets related to that. But as a general matter, there is really no national narrative that anybody's been able to stitch together to explain why these things are happening. There seem to be very local conditions, disputes between gangs, relations, and maybe lack of legitimacy in some of these communities between the police and those communities that they served, where people are sort of, as you say, taking the law into their own hands, and things like this that are driving those trends rather than anything that's a big picture national economic or demographic explanation.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about the decline in the incarceration rate. Is it that more people are being released from prison, fewer people are being sentenced to prison? What is going on there?
It's a combination of both things. And at this point, Marty, there are more than 33 states that have, in the past 8 years, enacted some type of comprehensive sentencing and corrections reform. And these are blue states and red states in the South, in New England, and out West, where bipartisan majorities, in fact, in most cases, large bipartisan majorities, and in some cases, unanimous majorities of state legislators have said, we have too many people in prison, and they're staying too long. We need to make sure, as the Philadelphia commissioner said a little bit ago, that those people who truly need to be behind bars are there. But this large number of lower-level offenders often whose behavior is driven by addiction to illegal substances, have to be in alternatives that work better and cost less. And so we have seen a wave of reform starting in Texas in 2007 designed to focus prison space on truly serious and violent offenders and to divert the lower level offenders to these alternatives. And it has started to work. We just in the report just out from the Justice Department tracking the incarceration rate, we've seen a drop from the peak of 1 in 100 in 2007-2008. Right at that point, we had literally 1% of the adult population in this country either in prison or jail, 1 in 100 adults. And that has now fallen back on account of these reforms in this broad range of states, down to 1 in 115 adults. Now that's progress.
I was going to say that's small still, progress, though, wouldn't you say?
It is, especially when you consider that it is still about 4 times higher than the historical rate of incarceration in this country, and many, many times higher than rates of incarceration in other industrialized nations.
Is that because it's hard to change policy? And I wonder how much cost is a driver. I know certainly here in Pennsylvania, there's been discussion about just what it costs to keep someone behind bars. You could send them to Harvard University.
Cost has been a significant motivator, but at the end of the day, it is not what is getting states like Texas and South Carolina and Georgia and Mississippi and others to change their laws. There are really 3 things that are going on. One is that they're seeing the success of other states, and particularly their neighbors, in reducing crime and incarceration. Right? They're seeing that Texas slammed the brakes on its prison construction back in 2007, and at this point has saved over $3 billion from what they would have expected to have spent if they'd continued to grow the way they did from the 80s up to 2007. They have not had to build or operate those $3 billion worth of prisons, and their crime rate has come down. They're seeing the success of South Carolina and other states do similar things. So that's one big piece of this, is state successes. The second is that the public does support this. Even though there's confusion about what's happening with crime, there is a very deep understanding that we cannot build our way out of this problem. And strong support up in the 70%, 80%, and often well more than 50% of the people across party lines supporting policies to divert lower-level offenders to alternatives. And there's been a big push on the conservative side, Marty, some of the strongest conservative voices in the country, whether that's been Grover Norquist or Newt Gingrich or other senior thought leaders on the conservative side of our political equation, come out and say these kind of things. And then third, and we think most importantly, Marty, is that in the past 15, 20 years, there have been developed a real solid research base of alternative programs that actually work to stop the cycle of recidivism. You know, we started down this prison building path 40 years ago, and that incarceration rate that had been flat through the night from the 1920s through the early 70s started to spike up. You know, at that point, we really didn't know what worked. We didn't know what programs were affected. Policies and practices were very very embryonic. And over the years, there's been a lot of research that shows exactly what does work and what doesn't work. And parole and probation agencies and corrections agencies across the country are and have been slowly adopting these things, and they're starting to work. And policymakers are seeing, hey, there is something we can do besides throw this person in a warehouse and hope they come out better.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Adam Gelb, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Director of the Public Safety Performance Project at the Pew Charitable Trust, talking about the declining crime and incarceration rate. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.